Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did America come together in the first half of the 19th century? While many of us were raised on the legend of the Great American Melting Pot, the reality of the struggle to form and maintain a shared national identity is both messier and more interesting than the mythology. Writer and historian Kenneth C. Davis tells half a dozen compelling but neglected stories from this critical time in our history, when our ancestors were grappling with some of the same questions over presidential power, immigrants' rights, and the role of the media that challenge us today. The new book is called A Nation Rising: Untold Tales of Flawed Founders, Fallen Heroes, and Forgotten Fighters from America's Hidden History. Ken, welcome back to Think.
It's always a great pleasure. Thank you, Chris. It's wonderful to be with you, and that was well done. That is quite a mouthful of a subtitle. So.
I practiced. Thank you. What was it about the first part of the 19th century that interested you as a sort of unifying time period for this book?
Well, I think it started with this idea of 67 years ago that we all heard about. You know, we heard that from or saw it in the Gettysburg Address, and this long period that goes between 1776 and 1863 or so, you know, the period from the founding to the great conflagration of the Civil War, had really fallen into what I call the black hole of American history for most of us. We go from George Washington marching off in triumph to the first shots at Fort Sumter without really understanding how did we get from 13 tiny states strung out along the eastern seaboard to a near empire that went from sea to shining sea. And I just found it a compelling period in which there were extraordinary characters, great people, great stories, but also this extraordinary expansion of the nation. And it wasn't as pretty as our textbooks would have had it when I was back in school.
You start the book with Aaron Burr, who most people, if they remember him at all, he's sort of a Trivial Pursuit question, Jefferson's vice president who fought that duel that killed Alexander Hamilton. Interestingly, that was hardly the most controversial thing he did in his long career in public life.
No, it was the perhaps the crowning moment of controversial moments in his life. But this gets back to something that I've loved as a historian, just as a lover of biography and American history for so long, that the villains are always some of the most interesting characters. I found that certainly with Benedict Arnold in a previous book, America's Hidden History, and wonderful little tidbit cropped up while I was doing Benedict Arnold. Mm-hmm. I read that when Aaron Burr was 19 years old, he went off with Benedict Arnold in the Maine woods during the American Revolution to attack Quebec. I thought, wow, to be a fly on that wall with the two of those guys marching through the Maine woods in winter, and what actually turned out to be a disastrous campaign, and I do briefly tell the story of that failed campaign, the attack on Quebec, which made Aaron Burr a Revolutionary War hero. There was a painting of Aaron Burr at the walls of Quebec that was a patriot icon, and so he was really well known in America. Of course, then in 1800, he runs for president ostensibly as the second candidate of his party behind Thomas Jefferson. But of course, in those days, under the original Constitution, the president was the first-place finisher, and the vice president was the second-place finisher. Unfortunately, they finished in a tie. The tie went to the House of Representatives, and 33 long ballots ensued. And Jefferson was not happy about this. He thought that Burr had really engineered this and was trying to deprive him of the presidency, and that just drove a wedge between the two of them. And the rest of the story that I tell in this chapter, which is called Burr's Trial, is really about his trial for treason in 1807. And the fact is that Jefferson had basically told Congress that Aaron Burr was committing treason. He charged him, tried him, and convicted him without benefit of judge or jury. But this was a sensation in its day. It was the media trial of the century in the 19th century.
So let's talk about what he was accused of doing. This is shortly after the Louisiana Purchase, and Jefferson accused Burr of trying to steal land that rightfully belonged to Spain and take it for himself.
Well, it's not quite clear what exactly he was trying to do. Historians still wonder what exactly he had in mind. There were three essential ideas, and it all had to do with the territory that had opened up to America with the Louisiana Purchase, as well as some territory that still belonged to Spain at that time, and that territory was Florida and Mexico, pretty valuable property, as well as this vast new territory that opened up with the Louisiana Purchase. We have to realize that America doubled in size overnight with the purchase of Louisiana in 1803. And really, the next 50 years, and what I write about in this book, is really the struggle for who's going to control that territory and what's going to happen to it. And so Burr's trial is really opens up onto this this battle for the land and the territory and the wealth that it meant that would carry over for the next 50 years and affect every political and other decision in America at that time.
So there were some really important precedents set by Chief Justice John Marshall during this trial. Can you talk about those?
That's right. Justice Marshall, who, by the way, is Jefferson's cousin, but bitter political rivals. Marshall, of course, perhaps the greatest Supreme Court Chief Justice of all time. He is the one who writes the decision that establishes the idea that the court can rule that an act of Congress is unconstitutional, and that, remembering from your high school days,
Marbury v. Madison,
that's exactly right. He was a Federalist. Jefferson, of course, was what he was called at that time, a Democratic Republican, the roots of the Democratic Party. But they were bitter, bitter rivals, and Jefferson would have done anything he could not only to destroy Burr, but also to take John Marshall down a few pegs. And Marshall was trying to do the same. And so this trial really becomes, in a way, a mano a mano between Jefferson and Marshall as well. And one of the things that Aaron Burr does in the course of this trial is subpoena the president. Imagine that. And Marshall allows it. So this was the court saying that no president, no man, including the president, was above the law. And that's an extraordinary precedent in our history. Marshall also more clearly defined what actually treason meant and what conspiracy to commit treason meant. So there were some important legal precedents that played out here that still have an impact on our courts and our politics today.
And in defining treason, essentially he said you have to be actively planning something. It can't simply be an idea or a thought that it would be great to commit treason.
That's right. And part of the defense was the fact that when this conspiracy supposedly took place, Aaron Burr wasn't even there. So how could he commit conspiracy when he wasn't there? What Burr was said to be trying to do was either to assault Florida, which was then in Spanish hands and very much desired by the United States, or attack Mexico, also in Spanish hands at the time, or carve out a piece of this great big Western territory and set himself up as an emperor with his daughter, his very beloved daughter, as his empress in waiting. And Burr went to his grave denying most of this, but he clearly had plans for some kind of military adventure, which the government at that time, the American government, probably wouldn't have minded if, in fact, Burr would have been able to throw Spain out of Florida. It happens a few years later anyway. Andrew Jackson is the man who makes it happen, and Andrew Jackson, coincidentally, is a bit player in the Aaron Burr conspiracy, the treason trial. So all of this gets woven together with this extraordinary cast of characters, and it really proves, if nothing else, that history is anything but boring. This is not a collection of dates and speeches. This is intrigue and conspiracy and conquest and political, raw political ambition right out in the open.
You mentioned Burr's daughter. He actually had some really interesting ahead-of-his-time ideas about women and their relative value and their intelligence.
Part of my fascination with the character of Burr, and you're absolutely right, because so many of us hear Aaron Burr and we only have that simple one line, he was the man who killed Alexander Hamilton, which, by the way, he was never charged with it. It was not a crime in New Jersey at that time. Dueling was not a crime. So he was never charged or tried for the death of Alexander Hamilton. And there were a good many people, I should point out as well, and I write about this in the chapter, particularly in the South, where he was eventually arrested, who thought that getting rid of Alexander Hamilton was not such a bad idea at all, to put it in pretty blunt terms. He was not popular. So having killed Alexander Hamilton, as far as many Southerners or Westerners, as they would have been called, would have been another a feather in Aaron Burr's cap. But he was, in going back earlier in his career, in the New York State Legislature, before he was vice president, he had actually put forth some of the first plans for emancipating slaves in New York. He also put forth a plan for giving women the vote. So he was an early suffragist, an early feminist, and you could call him. Very much a picture at odds with his libertine, woman-chasing character, which was really a picture that was painted by his opponents afterwards. He was dedicated to his own wife, and he was completely devoted to his own daughter, Theodosia, who he and his wife, who was also named Theodosia, had educated extremely well.
And we should say the reason that Alexander Hamilton was not popular in the South was in part due to his support for the idea of a national banking system.
That's right. Hamilton had put forth his famous plan to really get America back into financial health after the Revolution. That plan involved the purchase of bonds, and this was seen as something that was just going to enrich his New York, Northern, Eastern cronies at the expense of Southerners. And it's interesting to go back and you can see, even this early in American history, this kind of split between the bankers and Main Street. And it's fascinating to see how that split is something that we're still dealing with today, which is the real reason, I think, that we study history and learn history. It's fascinating. It's wonderful. The stories about these real people doing real things are compelling, but it's the connection to what is going on in our country and in our world today that I find so extraordinary, and there are so many examples of it in this book.
Burr ultimately prevailed in that treason trial. He was found not guilty, but then he died really a broken man.
He more or less died a broken man. He had to leave the country because even though he was acquitted in the trial, there were many people who had bought into Jefferson's belief that he was a traitor, and he escaped to Europe and still tried for the next couple of years to get European backing for this plan that he still had to take some of these territories and either separate them out or to take them for America. He never got that funding and backing. So he actually comes back to New York in disguise, wearing a mustache and under an assumed name. But he eventually, because he was such a brilliant lawyer and was still well-connected in some respects, he begins to build up a law practice again in New York, and begins to mentor another young New York politician whose name is Martin Van Buren. And that's where the connection keeps going, because Martin Van Buren, of course, ultimately becomes a member of the Jackson cabinet and then, of course, president himself.
We'll talk more about Andrew Jackson in just a moment. Kenneth C. Davis is my guest. His new book is called A Nation Rising, Untold Tales of Flawed Founders, Fallen Heroes, and Forgotten Fighters from America's Hidden History. We'll resume the conversation in a moment. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or emailing think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer and historian Kenneth C. Davis is my guest this hour. His newest book is called A Nation Rising, Untold Tales of Flawed Founders, Fallen Heroes, and Forgotten Fighters from America's Hidden History. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or sending email to think@kera.org. Ken, so much in this book reminds us that the treasured myth of the Great American Melting Pot is just that, a myth.
Yes.
Why do we cling to that sanitized version?
It's a really good and important question, and it's one that I deal with all the time. In 20 years of doing this and talking about history and why we have this mythology, it's a question that comes up time and time again. And by the way, Chris, I also have to say, in 20 years of doing this, I've never before had been able to say to a host, I'm following you on Twitter now, but it's true.
Times are changing, aren't they?
Times indeed are changing, and it's an interesting, of course, period to be both a writer and somebody who looks at how media has changed, and that's a fascinating part of this story, too, because the media was changing very much in the 19th century. But to your specific question about the myths, you know, we like to paint a portrait of the past that gives people a sense of pride and patriotism, and unfortunately what that does then is obscure some of the less savory moments, but they are just as important a part of our history. We do have a myth from this period of the steadfast pioneer heading west and encountering Indians along the way and having to make his way. And then there's the myth of also from this period of the settler coming to the immigrant coming to America and mixing into the so-called melting pot. Well, this period and some of the stories I tell in A Nation Rising really paint a very different picture of both of those images. With respect to the second one, the myth of the melting pot, it was a period in which anti-immigration fervor in America reached such a high pitch that it ultimately led to bloodshed. And I write about this in a chapter about the Philadelphia Bible riots. And many people will say, scratch their head and say, what Bible riots? And the fact is that the city of brotherly love was torn in two in the summer of 1844. More than two dozen people died. Hundreds of homes were burned to the ground. Churches were also destroyed. And this was rioting that was due to two simple factors, immigration and religion. And they were related at that time.
People associated Catholicism with undesirable kinds of immigrants, including the Irish.
That's especially the Irish. This was a period of the first Great Depression in American history, a downturn that started the Panic of 1837. The Irish were said to be scum unloaded on American wharves. They were cheapening labor prices and taking American jobs. Gee, doesn't that sound familiar? They were accused of bringing diseases into America. Doesn't that sound familiar? In fact, there had been a terrible outbreak of cholera and typhus in Philadelphia. They were called the Irish diseases at the time. Of course, they are the diseases that are really spread by poor sanitation. At the time, some reports showed there were 50 or more families living in Philadelphia, Irish immigrant families, with a single privy. So the problems of sanitation were very real. Underneath it all, there was something else bubbling around, and that was this widely held belief that Catholics were coming to America, Irish Catholics in particular, to take over the government and turn America over to the Pope, and that there was going to be a new Vatican built in Cincinnati, of all places. It almost sounds funny now to say it in retrospect, but this was not a fringe cult saying this. This was mainstream American Protestant ministers saying this from their pulpits, and people like Samuel F.B. Morse, the developer of the telegraph, who also was a vicious, vicious, and violent anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic. And a lot of this goes back, of course, to the Puritans coming to America and bringing the attitudes that of anti-popery, anti-papism to America, and it lasted for a long time. But as I also show in the book, this even goes back to an earlier time in Pennsylvania. Benjamin Franklin in the 1750s was complaining about the immigrants who were coming into Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, and they couldn't speak English, and all their signs were in another language, and they weren't teaching their children English. And he was talking about the Germans then. So each generation, in a way, has had to confront this. And, of course, as we know, we're dealing with questions of religion and immigration still today.
Let's go to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll speak with Mike in Dallas. Right. Hello, Mike.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I got a question. I hear people every day saying politicians are worse than they've ever been, and they're out to destroy America. And has that just always been the prevailing belief? I mean, have they just always seemed worse than they've ever been and corrupt? And you know what I mean?
What do you think, Ken?
Well, I think politicians are people, and we have to remember that. And that's part of this idea that we like to paint this portrait of the past that in which people like Jefferson are marble statues or on the side of Mount Rushmore. And, in fact, they were human beings with flaws and failings and contradictions. They still accomplished extraordinary things. But I think it becomes a lot more interesting to see them in the full range of their abilities. But this period shows that politicians have always had personal ambitions, egos, agendas, political and otherwise, and that has always factored into what happens on the national scene. And to think that these were the good old days when gentlemen debated the finer points of governance and then went back and sipped sherry together is really a tremendous myth. The founders were not a colonial era Kiwanis club. They disliked each other. There were personal dislikes, and of course, we mentioned Burr and Hamilton. The dislikes in that case boiled over into an outright killing. Andrew Jackson had some dealings with people that also resulted in death, as I point out in this book. So, you know, we think that because we have this gauzy, nostalgic view of the past, that somehow things were better back then. But politics has always been a dirty, bare-knuckled business, and this period, I think, proves it as well as any.
Let's talk about Andrew Jackson. One of the things that happened during his presidency was an attack on a military outpost called Fort Mims. And he essentially used this and the terror that it incited, which you compared to 9/11 amount of terror, to consolidate power for himself.
Well, actually, just one correction there. The chronology is a little bit off. This occurred in 1813, well before he was president. At the time, he was still a fairly obscure planter and lawyer in Nashville, Tennessee. He had had no real military experience at the time. And Fort Mims, and this is another of these pieces of hidden history, one of these untold tales, was the worst frontier attack in terms of loss of life in American history. Many people would think frontier, and they'd be thinking, you know, the Wild West and the Sioux or the Cherokees. But the worst attack on American settlers actually took place in what became the future state of Alabama. This was land that was being opened up after the Louisiana Purchase, and, of course, there were people living there. They happened to be Creek Indians, and the Creeks were a very, very powerful nation. They had actually gone to London and made trade agreements with London before there was an America, also giving a lie to the sort of the myth that that America was full of these savages. They were quite willing to adapt to European style and trade and were quite successful at it. They were led, in fact, by a young man named William Weatherford, which doesn't sound much like a Native American name, and that's part of the complication here. His father was a Scots trader. His mother was a Creek Indian princess, and he led the Creek Indians in this assault on Fort Mims in response to this, and it was a massacre of the worst sort. There's no denying that, and it was, as I write, a kind of 9-1-1 moment, and every generation, when you look at American history, has these moments, whether it's Pearl Harbor or Fort Sumter, when it seems like all hell is really breaking loose, and it, of course, sets the nation in a panic. Andrew Jackson led some Tennessee militiamen in a long war, a kind of nasty, ruthless war against the Creek Indians. It finished at a battle called Horseshoe Creek. Jackson supposedly had his men cut the noses off the dead to count the casualties after it was over, which is one of the reasons that led to his being nicknamed Sharp Knife by the natives, with whom he then had a long and very bloody struggle that lasted right through his presidency.
How did that campaign overall change the way that sort of average Americans felt about the federal government and its exercise of power over Native American nations?
Well, you know, for that, the answer to that really goes back to the very beginnings of the arrival of Europeans here and this very, very sad, tragic, and often bloody confrontation between Europeans and Anglo-Americans and Native Americans. It changed in the South in this period, in the Southeast in this period, because there were what were known as five civilized tribes throughout most of what is now Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and into Florida. These, for the most part, were Native nations that were doing what George Washington and Thomas Jefferson had hoped. They were adapting to European-style farming. They had begun to adopt European-style dress. They had welcomed some missionaries to a degree, but it was also the beginning of a great reaction against what was obviously the loss of all of their lands and all of their property and all of their traditions. So you have someone like Tecumseh, the great Indian leader who tried to create a confederation of Indian tribes that would battle the Americans. And he actually joins with the British in the War of 1812. The Creek Indians try and do the same thing, and they are defeated by Jackson in 1813. And this war continues for the next 30 or 40 years or so until finally almost all of the Native American tribes are removed, and that was the federal term, removal. It's kind of a nice, neat euphemism for essentially ethnic cleansing. The Southeast was ethnically cleansed of the Native American tribes who were there and had really tried to do what they were asked by the federal government. But in the end, it was just the insatiable desire for more land, more territory, mostly on which to grow cotton, that drove this.
We have an email here from Greg who writes, "One thing most people don't know about is the evolution of voting rights, especially that it was denied not only to women and minorities, but also to white men without property in many states. It is my understanding that Alabama was the first state to unequivocally give the vote to all white men, even those without property. Can you say more about this first incremental extension of voting rights beyond the privileged classes that occurred in the Jacksonian era?"
It's an excellent point, and it's one of the things that Jackson is most credited with, in a sense, this period when voting rights were really opened up to not just the elite. And in the colonial and the early national days, the first days of the Republic, it was really the elite. You did have to be a property holder. And that's what the men who wrote the Constitution had in mind. They did not believe in wide open democracy necessarily. They were afraid of farmers like Daniel Shays, who was up in Massachusetts, who raised an army to fight the state government there, because they thought democracy rule was one step removed from mob rule, and that's not what they wanted. So it was an incremental thing. I am not sure. The writer's point is well taken. I'm not sure if Alabama was the first place such a step was taken, but it was slow and it was incremental, and of course, even slower when it came to allowing blacks and, of course, women to vote as well. So this, although some states did permit suffrage much earlier than others, particularly some of the western states, it's interesting to see.
We have an email here from Bob in Irving who writes, "As a Democrat, I've doubted the propriety of the second half of the Jefferson-Jackson Day tradition in my party. Can you offer an opinion?"
Could you repeat that question?
Yeah. He says, "As a Democrat, I've doubted the propriety of the second half of the Jefferson-Jackson Day tradition in my party."
Did he say doubted it?
Yes, he's not sure it's proper to have Jackson honored along with Jefferson.
Well, it's a point that I bring up in the introduction in this book, that there are people, mostly descendants of Native Americans, who won't use a $20 bill mm-hmm. because Andrew Jackson's face is on it. And this, again, points up to the contradiction between the heroic version of a man considered to be one of the greatest presidents. He's still ranked usually in the top 20, if not in the top 10, largely because of his effectiveness as president. But, there's a view of him as the great proponent of the individual rights and the individual man and opening up the White House to the Westerners, who then had a bit of a wild party on his inauguration day, and he actually ended up escaping through a window and heading off to a hotel. So I think that this is the two sides of the coin of any politician. I mean, there are people who would say, well, Jefferson shouldn't be honored in a democratic tradition. After all, he's a slaveholder. And so I think it's a matter of degree and how you see these so-called founding fathers, and whether we can appreciate their accomplishments and still make space for their shortcomings as people. And you always, of course, have to put those shortcomings and the things they did into the context of the times. I don't want to oversimplify it, and you cannot judge an Andrew Jackson specifically by 21st century standards, but you can certainly judge him by human standards, and sometimes his standards fell unconscionably low. On the other hand, there's a wonderful story that I relate about how during this Creek War, he's walking through the remnants of the battlefield, and he sees an infant, and some of his soldiers are wondering what to do, and there really is the thought to just put the child to a sword, because all of the others, Indians, are dead. And Jackson actually takes this child and has him sent back to his home, and he was raised as Jackson's adopted son. So you have this wonderful contradiction of this man who was, by all accounts, a potent killing machine, yet was still able to open up his house to an orphan child of his enemy.
Back in a second with Kenneth C. Davis.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Hundreds of personal and professional development courses start this summer. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer and historian Kenneth C. Davis. His new book is A Nation Rising, Untold Tales of Flawed Founders, Fallen Heroes, and Forgotten Fighters from America's Hidden History. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Another myth that you take to task here is the idea that until around the Civil War, most Americans who were held in slavery in the Old South essentially resigned themselves to their fate. Can you tell us about Madison Washington?
Madison Washington is probably one of those people most of us never heard of, including me when I started work on this book. I think a lot of us have heard of the Amistad Rebellion and maybe even seen the Steven Spielberg film about that revolt on a slave ship. This is another one that kind of got lost in the pages of history. It was the ship was called Creole. Madison Washington was a slave who had actually escaped via the Underground Railroad. We're talking about the mid-1830s here, and had made his way to Canada, but he decided that he wanted to go back and try and free his wife as well. Very audacious move, and unfortunately he was captured while trying to do that. He was put on a slave ship that was going from Virginia down to New Orleans, which was then the most notorious of America's slave auctions. Now, at this time, the slave trade with Africa was illegal, but slave trade between the states was still permitted. Madison Washington and some of his fellow captives on the Creole mutiny, take control of the ship, sail it to the Bahamas, where slavery under the British Empire has been abolished. and they're essentially treated as heroes. And this caused a kind of a diplomatic row between the Great Britain and the United States at the time. It was eventually settled in court. But the story of the uprising, which really gets overlooked, is typical of the large number of insurrections and rebellions and very, very bloody uprisings that took place throughout the slaveholding South that were really erased from the image. A lot of us grow up with the Gone with the Wind image of the, you know, happy slave, the paternalistic slave system, the big house slave. And this history of these insurrections, I think, really is a corrective to that still kind of paternalistic and kind of mythologized view. The other interesting part of it is almost all of these slave rebellions and insurrections were inspired by the model, the example of Haiti. Of course, Haiti's been back in the news for other reasons, but Haiti was the second republic to be formed in the Western Hemisphere. It was formed when former slaves rebelled against their French and British masters and created a new republic. It was bloody, it was horrible, it was bloody and vicious on both sides. But American slave owners dreaded the notion that their slaves would learn about this, and that's one of the reasons that slaves were not allowed to read, so that they wouldn't find out about what had happened on Haiti. But word got around, it spread, it was its own version of the internet in the day, and this uprising inspired a great many other insurrections in America, and I try and tell that story in this book as well.
One of the most interesting characters for me to read about that I had not heard of before was a woman named Jessie Benton Fremont. And among many qualities, she was an exceptionally courageous person.
She was courageous, and you're right, most of us haven't heard of her, but in her day, she was probably the most famous woman in America, certainly among the two or three most famous women in America. Maybe Harriet Beecher Stowe was a little bit more famous, but not by much. Jessie Benton Fremont was the wife of Colonel John Fremont, known as the Great Pathfinder. He was the explorer who opened up California and the West to the pioneers, and he blazed the trails. He brought back these reports and surveys that he had done as a surveyor, and Jessie helped him write them. And she was very key in making it a little bit more popular, making it accessible, really creating this image of the great adventure of moving west. And the two of them were truly a power couple in their day. If the People had magazine had been around in the 1840s, they would have been on the cover half the time. She was also the daughter of the most powerful senator in America at that time, Thomas Hart Benton of Missouri. And this combination of her father and this extraordinary explorer had these two very powerful men in her life. I start the chapter about Jessie Benton Fremont out with her travel when she's about 24 years old with her very young daughter to California during the gold rush, but they go by way of the Isthmus of Panama, and of course there was no canal then. They had to go by boat and then by mule cart and mule train over the mountains. It was a harrowing trip. Just a picture of what life was like for this extraordinary woman in the middle of the 19th century. She then, of course, I should say he then went on to become the first presidential candidate of the Republican Party as an abolitionist, the first Republican, and she was quite an asset. They really campaigned together, and he lost partly because of his abolitionist views, but partly because he was accused of being, surprise, surprise, not born in America.
His own birther controversy.
He had a 19th century birther controversy. He was said to be French-Canadian, and in fact his father was, but he was clearly born in America. And there was something else. He was also said to be Catholic. French-Canadians were often Catholic. He and Jessie had eloped when she was 17. The only one who would agree to marry them was a Catholic priest. So this conjunction of evidence that he was a Catholic and a Canadian really also was part of the controversy in 1856 when he ran for president.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Back to the phones now. We'll speak with Robert in Dallas. Hello, Robert.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently heard that when Burr and Hamilton fought their duel, Hamilton was actually distraught over the loss of his son in a duel prior to this one, and that Hamilton actually fired into the air and that Burr went ahead and shot him anyway, and I wanted to know if that was true.
Well, that's a mystery that's still unsettled. Unfortunately, there was no CSI around at the time, but there has been a great deal of forensic detective work done in the intervening century. To the first point, you're absolutely right. Hamilton was not fond of dueling. His son had been killed. In fact, I believe the pistols used in the Hamilton-Burr duel were the pistols used in his son's death. Mm-hmm. So it must have been a bittersweet moment. Hamilton's allies did say that he fired his shot in the air. Now, dueling at the time, that was often typical. You went out and you stood there and you stood your ground, but then everybody agreed you were just going to fire in the air. Everyone could leave with their honor intact. There's a flip side to it that says Burr and Hamilton fired very close together. Burr's bullet, his ball, hits Hamilton and causes him to fire high as opposed to a deliberate high shot. We don't really know, and there are many books about the duel, and there are some wonderful books, and everyone seems to be either pro-Burr or pro-Hamilton, more pro-Hamilton, it seems. But that's one we will have to leave to the mysteries of history.
So Burr didn't write anything saying this is what I intended to do.
Well, he's credited as saying we both shot, he missed, I never do. I guess I'll leave it at that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the lines to Michael in Denton. Hey, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
All right. I was actually just going to kind of call you out and firmly disagree with you about saying that Andrew Jackson, like, was a kind person because he went and, like, took in this baby off of a battlefield, because I really can't imagine, like, someone going in, like, doing ethnic cleansing and committing, like, genocide on an entire race of people and then just so happening to, like, take in one of their children is an act of kindness at all.
Well, you're not arguing that this redeems his character necessarily, are you?
No, I don't say this is an act of redemption. It just points up to the fact that people are so complicated. And this is a human side of the story that probably a lot of people who don't like Andrew Jackson may have never heard. I tell this story because it's true. And it speaks a little bit to Jackson's character and his own history, perhaps, which I think is important. And I didn't go into this earlier, but Jackson himself was an orphan. His father died shortly after he arrived from Scotland. Jackson never knew him. His mother came to America pregnant, so he Andrew Jackson was born American, but his father died before his birth. He saw one brother die in the Revolution. He saw another brother die after being taken captive by the British and being wounded while they were held prisoner. And then his mother died while she was trying to tend to prisoner of war victims on a boat. So his entire family was wiped out. Perhaps somewhere that feeling of the orphan child of the battlefield factors into this. I don't want to be the armchair psychologist, but it's really more about presenting a whole picture of the man as opposed to these kind of simplistic views of this guy was a good guy or this guy was a bad guy. These were people with complicated characters and complicated agendas.
We've got time for one more call, and we'll speak to David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Great show as always.
Thank you.
Hey, I love the story about Fremont. I always tell my friends, if I learn something new about history on any given day, then that's a great day, because I didn't know that that was one of the reasons he lost that election was because of his source of origin. Who'd have thought in a nation of immigrants that would come up? But I'd like to ask the guests, you know, there's so many anecdotal stories you can talk about of U.S. history. What would be the one, either from your book or just from your own knowledge of history, that you feel more people should know about that don't?
Oh gosh, I've spent 20 years putting those stories together in either in my Don't Know Much About History series or now in this new book, A Nation Rising. So hard to come down to a single story because there are so many at so many junctures in our past. But I'll pull one out of this book, and we discussed it briefly, just because it's so typical of our missing knowledge, the Bible riots, and I think I referred to them earlier in Philadelphia, 1844, when this city, which we celebrate as the birthplace of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, was torn in part by sectarian fighting. And we Americans like to sometimes look over at Baghdad or Rwanda or any of these other places where there's sectarian fighting and wonder how people of the same country can do it. And we've done it ourselves, and that's the instructive part of history.
It's so interesting to think about, you know, historians 200 years from now trying to comb through what's happening today, given that there are so many very vocal sources of opinion and analysis on all sides of the things we argue about currently. Do you have any thoughts about how they'll do that?
Oh, that's such a tough one because, you know, we think about the enormity of resources that they'll have, presumably, short of, you know, us blowing the whole thing up, to go back and look. And I guess now, since all of the tweets are going to be cataloged in the Library of Congress, it will be a difficult task for the future historian to weave through all of this. But one of the things about this period that I've written about is the fact that the newspapers were such a vibrant part of the political conversation at that time. And we think of, you know, fair and balanced or media bias today. Back then, there was no pretense of bias. The newspapers were really owned by people who had a political platform. In many cases, they were owned by politicians. Burr owned a newspaper that covered his trial. In fact, Washington Irving was the reporter. I write about that in this new book. Washington Irving covered Aaron Burr's trial as a young reporter for the New York Observer at the time. Jefferson had his own newspapers. They were openly partisan, and it's a wonderful source to go back and look. So I'm sure historians of the future will have a rich source of all this video and internet tweets and everything that we are doing each day. That is this extraordinary cacophony of political voices in America today.
The latest book by writer and historian Kenneth C. Davis is called A Nation Rising, Untold Tales of Flawed Founders, Fallen Heroes, and Forgotten Fighters from America's Hidden History. Ken, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure for me. It's always great to talk to you. Bye.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.